Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on September 3rd, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. So what that means is you can either in the chat box submit that you have a question or say that you want to come online and we can turn on your microphone and have you speak to all of us here on Tax Resolution Institute. I will announce when the Q&A session has begun, and then at that point is when we will allow for you to come online. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, and be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second Tuesday this month, we have a free webinar on tax resolution A to Z. This two-hour webinar touches on every aspect of tax resolution. On the third Tuesday this month, we have another free webinar on IRS appeals. And on the fourth Tuesday this month, we have a free webinar on how to make money today with tax resolution. If you forget when these happen, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we are here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And before we jump into the questions, I do want to just take a quick minute to announce a couple of the events that are coming up. Our annual event is coming up on November 14th. This is a full day event, 8 hours, talking about resolution, and we are offering CPE credit for that. So with this course, you are going to learn how to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income, learn how to easily perform the work you dread the most, learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. And just like we do every single year, we will offer this both in person and live in a conference room, or you can view it over the internet on the webinar, much like what we're doing today. So mark your calendars, November 14th. I will be sending a link to the event page. There are early bird specials now if you want to register now, but we will also send it to you in a follow-up email after this event concludes. All right, so enough about that. Let's go ahead and get started with the questions. And just another quick reminder, VIP members get priority on these calls. So this first round of questions are coming directly from VIP members. More on how you can become a VIP member yourself and all the perks that go along with it in a little bit. So moving on, Norman, our first question is from Tony. Tony's a CPA. He is a member, and he's asking, client just had some taxes survive his personal bankruptcy because they are recent years, 16 and 17. I want to submit an offer for him. The surviving taxes are about $25,000, but he discharged about $60,000. Through the BK, he proved his insolvency. Will the IRS expedite the offer process because of this? Anything I should look out for?
Well, the short answer to your question is no, and that's because, first of all, there are several definitions of bankruptcy. One definition is if a person's liabilities exceed his assets, then he's on the asset equity table, he has negative equity, and that could be a definition of bankruptcy. Another definition of bankruptcy can be lack of disposable income. So, for instance, someone's expenses exceed his income. That may be a definition of bankruptcy. Now, for offer purposes, first of all, a $25,000 tax amount is relatively low, and I'm not sure what you plan on charging for an offer, but it just may not make economic sense to pay for an offer and pay the amount of the offer on a tax of about $25,000. It may be easier and cheaper to do a streamlined installment agreement where no financials are necessary, and you just take the $25,000 and divide by 72 months, and that would be your monthly payment amount. So for the offer, what you would want to do is you use some kind of program or fill in the 433A OIC and determine two things. Number one is what, if any, equity does the taxpayer have in property? And second would be, what, if any, disposable income do they have? And after looking at that, you may determine what the amount of the offer is that you would submit. There's two kinds of offers. There's one that's a lump sum payment, which can be paid over 6 months. The other one is a periodic payment, which can be paid over years. And we always suggest that you do the lump sum. So determine what the lump sum offer would be. And also remember that an offer can take up to 2 years to be rejected or accepted. So it could be a lengthy process. So my suggestion is to first do something like a 433 AOIC to determine how much the offer will be for. And then you can determine whether or not an offer is better or not than an installment agreement based on no financials.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Tony, hopefully that answers your question and gives you a little bit of guidance there. Moving on to our next member, Grace. Grace is an EA and is asking, I am taking on a trust fund recovery penalty case and getting ready for a 4180 interview. The IRS wants to meet with the owners and the office manager. The office manager is just an employee and does not have an ownership interest in the corporation. Is there a quick way to keep the IRS from focusing on him?
Okay, so unfortunately, even though the office manager is just an employee and doesn't have any ownership interest in the corporation, it doesn't mean that he's exempt from being determined to be a responsible person and to be assessed the trust fund recovery penalty. So if you're trying to keep him out of the process, I guess the best way would be to have the IRS revenue officer first interview the owner or owners. And the owner or owners should answer the questions in such a way not to implicate the office manager. So, for instance, there's two parts to the 4180 interview. First goes to responsibilities and duties. So they're going to ask who had authorization to sign checks, who had authorization to determine which creditors were paid and which creditors weren't paid and things like that. And so if they answered in a way where the office manager didn't sign checks, didn't have authority to determine who was paid and who wasn't paid, didn't sign tax returns, stuff like that, then there's a good chance that the owners will be determined to be responsible persons and the office manager won't be interviewed. But again, it's no guarantee. Because what the IRS is looking for is during the period that these payroll taxes liabilities were growing, the business took in some money. I mean, it wasn't that they weren't taking in any income at all. And they were spending some of that money. So they were paying maybe rent in the office or utilities to keep the lights on. They were paying the employees' salaries. They were paying vendors or whatever. And so someone made the decision to pay all these people and not the IRS. And so they want to know who that person was, and they want to go after them personally for the amount of tax that was withheld from the employee's salary but not forwarded to the IRS, kept by the corporation. So basically, the corporation borrowed money from the IRS, and now the IRS wants to be paid back, and they're going to go after whoever they can to get their money. The IRS feels that they're involuntary partner, and they don't like that position. So look at the questions towards on responsibility section and answer it in a way that only the owners had responsibility for those duties. And then the second part is willfulness, which goes to knowledge. So the question is, who knew that taxes were going unpaid? You know, who knew that some people were being paid and the IRS wasn't? So again, if you wanted to protect the office manager, you would paint a picture that he didn't know about the tax situation because he didn't get notices or whatever. So there's a responsibility and then there's willfulness. And if he's not subject to those, then he probably won't be interviewed. And if he is interviewed, he won't be assessed the trust fund recovery penalty.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Next question is for Ambrose. Actually, Ambrose, you're an EA and also a member. Your question is best directed for one of our tax professionals, so we will get you a response. But your question is regarding a claim for refund and request for abatement, and it deals with whether or not it was timely filed and whether or not that the IRS can deny that request. So that is best answered from one of our tax professionals. So I will work on getting you a response to that directly. Please feel welcome to use some of that consultation time if you need to go into it in further detail. But again, as a reminder to everyone that's online, VIP members will get their questions answered, and you can also use that consultation time that you have to go into any topic or any question you have in detail and make sure that you understand it thoroughly. So Ambrose, I will get back to you on that. Larry has a question. Norman is also a member, and he's asking, if an offer is submitted and received by the IRS, the confirmation letter was received, will they now be able to receive a refund if they file a return? We've been waiting to file the 2018 return because of this.
Unfortunately, the short answer is no. Part of the terms of accepting an offer is that any refunds for years of tax returns that were filed up to the year that the offer was submitted won't be returned. They'll keep the refund. So when you file, I assume that the offer was submitted in 2019 and you're going to be filing the 2018 return also in 2019, that the part of the offer will be that the IRS will keep that refund if the offer then gets accepted in 2019. When you file the 2019 return in 2020, you should be able to keep that refund. But the refund for 2018 return filed in 2019 will be kept by the IRS.
Now, does that happen also, Norman, if you know, let's say they filed the 2018 return late. Let's say they decide to file it in 2020.
Well, no, because a part of an offer is that you're staying in compliance.
True, correct.
So if they, but I'm assuming that 2018 is on extension. Otherwise, they'd already be out of compliance.
Right.
So let's say it's on extension till October. If they don't file it timely in October, they'd be out of compliance, and the offer could be rejected for being out of compliance. Now, this time they're expecting a refund, so that's not an issue. But if they weren't expecting a refund, if they owed, they could still be out of compliance, because even though the return was on extension and not due until October, the tax was due in April. And so if they file the return late or not late, if they file it on extension in October, but they pay late, then that failure to pay penalty could also put them out of compliance and jeopardize the offer.
Right.
So in any case, they should go ahead and file it.
Right. All right, Larry. So much for that idea, but there you go. And hopefully that answers your question. Moving on to Harold. Harold is asking, I have a client that has serious delinquent tax liability, over $200,000. He has neglected to file some returns, was audited for a few that he did file, and had additional taxes assessed. He is concerned that the IRS will come after him and put him in jail. Can you explain when the IRS refers to criminal investigation department?
Right. So so just owing taxes isn't the crime. It's filing fraudulent returns that gets you in trouble. The fact that I guess some returns weren't filed, so I'm assuming that the IRS prepared SFRs. And so, again, SFRs doesn't necessarily subject you to criminal investigation. And then there was the audit for returns that were filed. And again, it would depend if the audit just disallowed some expenses because he didn't have proper verification, or did he not list some income that he had, which and the IRS had 1099s or something to substantiate them. But this case doesn't seem one that would be referred to criminal investigation. I've been here 11 years and we've had maybe one case that was referred to criminal investigation. So it doesn't happen very often. And this case doesn't seem, from the little that you told me, to be one that would, unless there's something that you're not telling me. But from based on what you're telling me, I wouldn't be too concerned.
All right, Harold, there you go. And most cases are not going to get referred to CI. It's just a matter of the willfulness. But moving on to Bianca, another member is asking, I'm reviewing my client's IRS account transcripts to try and determine when the statute for collection expires. Can you discuss the most common tolling events when calculating this? I think they are nearing the end, but the IRS just levied the client's bank account.
Okay, so you can try doing this on your own by going through the account transcript. Another way is by calling ACS and simply asking them, what's the CSET dates on the years with outstanding balances? And they'll tell you the date. It's not a secret. The other thing is, like, we have software that calculates the date. So you might have software that does that for you. But if you're doing it the old-fashioned way, look at the transcript. And when you want to look for our tolling events that are submitting an offer and compromise tolls the statute, submitting a request for an installment agreement tolls the statute, filing a collection due process request for a hearing tolls the statute, being out of the country for more than 6 months tolls the statute. So anything of bankruptcy, being in bankruptcy tolls the statute. So anything that stops or delays collection tolls the statute, because the IRS wants their full 10 years to collect. And so anything that stops the clock on collection will stop the clock on the collection statute. So that's what you want to look for: our offers, installment agreements, appeals, collection due process, bankruptcies, and being out of the country.
Right. And if you look at the transcript itself, when you see the entry that the tax was assessed or examination was processed, at the bottom of that header, you'll see a date that's on there. There's no designation, but there's
a date. I think that's based on 10 years.
Right.
From the date of that assessment.
So that's their starting point,
right.
And then they calculate the tolling events after.
Right. And there might be tolling events that occur after that.
Correct.
It wouldn't show on that.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much, Bianca. Moving on to Jeremy. Jeremy is asking, how does one know when the CSET begins and ends? Where do you find it on the transcripts? I think we just covered that a little bit there, Jeremy.
So let me just say that it begins on the date of assessment. Because people ask that a lot. Is it the date the return is filed? Is it the date the return is received? No, it's the date that the tax is assessed. And 1 year can have more than one CSET because each assessment has its own CSET. So if there was tax based on the return and then there was some audit or exam or a 1099 came in late or whatever, then an additional assessment would generate an additional CSET. So you need to look at all the assessments, and each assessment has its own CSET.
All right, thank you very much. Moving on to Paul. Paul is also a member asking, is there a maximum penalty amount that can be abated under the first-time penalty abatement program? That seems to be a popular one, Norman. Can the FTPA program be applied to both individuals and businesses? How difficult is it to deal with the IRS and the FTPA program?
Okay, so first question, is there a maximum penalty amount? No, but remember the first time penalty abatement only addresses certain penalties like failure to pay and failure to file. I would say are the two most common penalties that can be abated under the first time penalty abatement program. The next question is, can it be applied to both individuals and businesses? And the answer is yes. And the next question is, how difficult is it to deal it? And it's not very difficult. You call ACS and you request first time penalty abatement and they'll look at it and come back to you and tell you that yes, the taxpayer qualifies, or no, they don't. And but one thing I just like to say is consider the first time penalty abatement program like a wild card. And so you only want to use it if you absolutely have to, because like the name implies it's a one-time thing. And so if the taxpayer has a penalty and you think you can abate it under the reasonable cause standard, I would attempt to abate it first under reasonable cause, and only if the taxpayer doesn't qualify for reasonable cause abatement to use the first time penalty abatement. Otherwise, if they qualify for reasonable cause grounds, I would use that and save the first time penalty abatement for another day.
That's a wise choice there. You don't want to use it because you do lose it. Moving on to Jacob here. My client owns a small family restaurant. It's an S corporation and has several employees, but is struggling to make the payroll tax deposits. I know CNC is available for income taxes, but is that also an option for payroll taxes? If so, can I expect from the IRS? What can I expect from the IRS when presenting them with the company's financials?
Okay, so the question is not completely clear, but I'm assuming that they have delinquent payroll taxes and that they're in some kind of installment agreement or negotiating an installment agreement with the revenue officer, and they're struggling to stay in compliance by making the current payroll tax deposits. And so they want to know if CNC is available, and usually not, because they take the payroll taxes very seriously, especially the trust fund. And so my other question would be, has anyone been assessed the trust fund recovery penalty? Because maybe if someone was assessed the trust fund and they're paying that penalty, there could be an argument that put the business into currently non-collectible because they don't want to jeopardize staying in compliance and making current tax deposits. The trust fund is being paid through the penalty assessed against individuals, and they just need a little breathing room because CNC, currently non-collectible, is by nature a temporary status, and so it's just can buy you some time. But if the trust fund isn't being paid and nothing's being paid, I don't think they're going to go for currently non-collectible because they really want to get paid. Because remember, they're out of pocket for the money that was withheld from the employees but not forwarded to the IRS. And so when those employees filed their tax return, they got credit for that withholding, even though it was never sent to the IRS, and may even qualify for a refund. And so the IRS is paying a refund on taxes that were never paid. So they're pretty strict on that.
Yeah, payroll taxes is one of the most collectible, or I should say aggressive collections that the IRS takes because of the nature of that tax. Moving on, Norman, to Thomas. Thomas is asking, the client CPA started an S corporation for the client in 2009. Tax return was filed as an S corporation. IRS correspondence to the client states that they have been a C corp since 2012 and is pressing for new filings. There is no paper trail of the client or the CPA making a change. Her former CPA has retired and went out of state. What is the best course of action to take?
So we've run across this sometimes, and sometimes you can get S-Corp determination retroactive. But in any case, I would apply for the S-Corp status now, and in the application ask that it be applied retroactively, so that at least worst case scenario is that you'll be an S corp going forward. But that's what you need to do. So, and just a heads up, taxpayers really should have records of these kinds of things and insist that their CPA send them copies of anything that's filed or submitted or given to the IRS or any other taxing agency.
Yeah, Thomas, if you look up the IRS website, they give you instructions on how to request late S-election, and it does give you some of the parameters. And one of those is whether or not it intended to be an S-corporation since the beginning. And the fact that they filed S-corporation since 2009 is going to work in your favor. So definitely look at those guidelines at theirs.gov and let us know if you have any questions, and we can help guide you through the rest. Okay, moving on to Carlton. Carlton is asking, I represent a non-filer. We have 6 years of tax returns for 2012, 2017. The transcripts indicate that the IRS prepared SFRs for years 2003 to 2007 in July of 2010. We were contacted by a private debt collection agency. Is there any relief available?
So I'm not sure what you mean by any relief. Are you looking to not pay the tax? Are you looking to pay it in installments or submitting an offer? So first of all, these SFRs that were all filed in July 2010, the thing makes me think that they were assessed then, and so that the CSED would expire in July of 2020. So you only have less than a year to go, and 2003 through 7 should become uncollectible. Now the 2012 through 17, if you filed all those returns recently, which I imagine because 2017 couldn't have been filed more than a year ago or so, you may want to set up a payment plan for those years. And you may want to wait until 2003 and 7 fall off before you do an installment agreement for 2012 through 17. And the reason I say that is because I don't know how much they owe for 12 to 17 or whether or not it qualifies for streamline. But it'd be easier to do it that way if the looming CSET for tax years 3 to 7 wasn't in the picture. Also, these private debt collection agencies are notoriously slow at collecting. And so you may want to ride it out until 3 to 7 fall off the radar and then deal with 12 through 17.
Right. Okay, Norman, thank you very much for that. Let me just take a quick minute here because I know a lot of you are wondering, how do I guarantee that my questions get answered? How do I get my questions to get to be priority during these forum calls? Well, the answer is you sign up for to become a VIP member. And as I always do for you folks that are online, I do offer you a free trial to test out the VIP membership program. Now with this free trial, you get up to 2 hours of consultation with the CPA or tax attorney or tax professional and any tax topic that you have or resolution topic that you have a question on. You get free access to videos on demand, access to our comprehensive library that includes white papers and a lot of information related to the individual solutions, including installment agreements, offers and compromise, innocent spouse relief, how to appeal IRS decisions, a lot of different information that's available to you. You also get free webinars, free e-learning courses, and you get discounts on everything else that's on our website. So in order to sign up, I'm going to be pushing a link now. This is exclusive to you folks that are online now to give you the 2-month free trial. Sign up, register, and start using that consultation time. I know a lot of you do have additional questions after we have these forums, so take advantage of that, and I will go ahead and push a link now to everyone that's online. But with that said, I'm going to go ahead and move on to the remainder of these questions. I will be opening it up to the Q&A session in about 2-3 more questions that we have left. So if you do have some, and I see a lot of you have gone online and have already submitted your question, please continue to do so, and we will do our best, time permitting, to get to all of them so that everyone gets their questions answered. All right, so that last one was from Carlton. Moving on to Gary. Gary is asking, a client has received an ASFR notice for 2 past 1040 returns, which we filed before the deadline. I'm talking to an IRS agent. He was informed that he needs to file 1120s for 4 past tax years. To date, he has not received any written notice from the IRS regarding the past due 1120s. He is struggling to pull together enough records to allow us to file the 1120s. Any idea on urgency if the IRS hasn't issued any written notices?
The answer is not really, but the question is, why wait till you get written notice that the 1120s are past due when you already know that they are and know that they're generating failure to file and failure to pay penalties? I don't see any benefit in delaying filing these returns. And so number one is I wouldn't wait for notices. I would start preparing, and I would file the delinquent returns as soon as possible and try to limit the amount of penalties that are going to be generated. And secondly is he's struggling to pull together enough records to allow you to file the 1120s. Makes me wonder whether or not he should be in business for himself, because he should be keeping records. It shouldn't be a struggle to have records necessary to prepare tax returns. So number one, they should be timely filed moving forward. Secondly, his records should be kept in such a way that preparing the returns shouldn't be a struggle. And third, delinquent returns should be prepared and filed as soon as possible.
Right. Thank you very much, Norman. And yes, in a perfect world, that's exactly what would happen. All of our clients would have their information. But as you're going to come across in this industry, most of the time, the documentation itself is key to whatever resolution we're coming up for the clients, including the preparation of delinquent returns. And that's usually the biggest hurdle that the taxpayers themselves have to overcome. So all we can do is teach them, guide them, train them, and hopefully they abide. So moving on.
But remember, it's difficult to say this to a client, but sometimes we have to, that not everybody should be self-employed, or not everybody should be running a business. Some people should be W-2 employees, subject to withholding, and the taxes are withheld from their pay, and it's relatively straightforward. And some people just don't have the discipline or whatever that's required to make estimated payments and keep proper records and so forth. So unfortunately, not everybody has what it takes to be self-employed.
All right, moving on to Shantae. Shantae, you submitted a question online prior to the event, and I have a couple of questions here for you online. So I'm going to do my best to address all of them as best as I can, okay? So Shantae is asking, when figuring out the net worth of an asset or the worth of an asset, what method is used? To find out the worth of a vehicle, do you use Kelley Blue Book? Do you do the same with the house, but with something like Realtor.com? If the client dies, what happens to the taxes owed by the client? Can you buy a home or sell a home while in the process of waiting for an OIC decision? Is future income based on future 10 years? Shantae, I can tell you're going to be a great candidate for our VIP membership, because these are definitely a lot of different questions.
It's kind of all over the place. I'll do the best to answer it. Okay, so the IRS uses fair market value, and they, on some assets, they take 80% of fair market value. So for instance, on a house, it's a fair market value, 80% of fair market value, but that's to take into consideration closing costs and commissions and, you know, the cost of selling a house and everything. But basically it's fair market value. And if a client dies, what happens to the taxes owed? The IRS will submit a demand to the estate to be paid. So it doesn't take the taxpayer off the hook. There's a demand would be made with the executor. And can you buy or sell a home while waiting for an OIC? Maybe you could, but I wouldn't. I mean, the whole thing, first of all, if you have an OIC pending, the IRS probably has a tax lien. And so if you sell your home, the IRS is going to get put a demand in escrow and get money from that, and that's going to affect the offer. So I think buying or selling a home is not a good idea while an offer is pending. And is future income based on future 10 years? Not necessarily. Future income is based on the life of the statute, because it doesn't really matter what your future income will be when the collection statute has expired and the tax becomes uncollectible. So they're really looking at what the income is in the future during the life of the statute. So on a newly assessed tax, it could be 10 years. On older taxes, it could be a year or less. After figuring out what an asset can be sold for, do you reduce that amount by 20% to include in financial interview? I'm not sure what that means, but like we said, if you look at the 433 AOIC to determine, which is a kind of the paperwork you go through to determine what the amount of the offer, it's 80% of fair market value. So I think you reduce the fair market value by 20% as your first step to
right.
determine whether or not there's equity. And then you take that number and you subtract the encumbrances against the property, and then that would determine the equity.
There you go, Shante. There's a lot of questions here, but you might consider also attending one of our webinars that we have, which, by the way, for the month of August, every Tuesday we have a separate or a different webinar going on, and those are absolutely free. Attend the one regarding offers, because it goes into the mechanics of an offer, including calculating the value of assets. And we do give you some tips on how to calculate, for instance, retirement accounts, how to look at hard assets like a vehicle or a home, and where to get that or gauge that information. So hopefully that guides you there and gives you some additional information, Shante. Okay, moving on to Javier. Javier is asking, during the OIC process, once you have submitted the form with application fee and first payment, are you supposed to continue the monthly payments even if the OIC has not been approved?
Okay, so there's two kinds of offers. I think we touched on this earlier. One is called the lump sum, and you put 20% down, and then the other 80% is due within 6 months of the offer being accepted. So the time that the offer is pending no payments are required. And the first payment towards the balance of the offer isn't due until 30 days after the offer is accepted. The second kind of offer is called periodic payment. And this is where the taxpayer is pledges monthly payments for not only the duration that the offer is pending, but until after the offer is accepted, and the payments continue for several years until the offer is paid in full. And so in that case, in periodic payment, yes, the taxpayer is making monthly payments towards the offer, even though the offer is only pending, and even if the offer is ultimately rejected. And I think it gives you an option where you can, they ask you, if the offer is rejected, where do you want the payments applied to the tax you owe, or do you want the payments returned to you? But again, I don't suggest periodic payment offers because the offer process can take up to 2 years. And so the taxpayer's been making monthly payments for 2 years. And at the end of all that, the offer could be rejected. And now he owes more than he started because the liability has been accruing interest the whole time that the offer's pending. So those are the two kinds of offers. One requires monthly payments, one does not.
All right, thank you very much. Hopefully that helps you there, Javier, because those two are very subtle differences, but very important differences when it comes to that offer. Moving on to Sylvia. Sylvia's asking, can you prove an amount of health care that exceeds the standard, or is the standard for health care the maximum that you cannot exceed?
No, so the standard is for out-of-pocket medical, and that's automatic. But if your out-of-pocket exceeds that, then you can be allowed that out-of-pocket to the extent that you can prove it. Because, I mean, the IRS doesn't want you to stop taking your medication or stop going to the doctor or whatever you need. So there is no limit to what your out-of-pocket medical expenses are as long as you can prove them and they're reasonable and necessary. I mean, if your out-of-pocket medical expenses is for plastic surgery so you can look like a movie star, your favorite movie star or whatever, that's not going to be allowed. But if it's a legitimate health reason and it's just that your copay or your out-of-pocket expenses that's not covered by your insurance, whatever it is allowed as long as you can prove it.
Thank you very much. Okay, moving on. This is the last of our pre-submitted questions. So those of you that have submitted the question online, we're going to get to them right after this. This is from Tui. Tui is asking, a taxpayer established a 529 account for her son, Ed. Ed will start college in fall 2019 and receives $28,000 scholarship for tuition, fee, room, and board. The cost to college is $32,000 per year. Tuition fee, $18,500. So Tui goes on to explain the difference in the income levels, and his question mainly relates to the distributions and whether or not or how much can be claimed as income or a deduction on the tax return. So, Tui, we don't have an answer for you, much like we had for Ambrose earlier on. This is best suited for one of our tax professionals. The difference here is that you are not a VIP member, but I do want to be able to get you this answer, Tui, but I strongly recommend that you do become a VIP member so that you can guarantee that these types of questions do get answered and that you do have an opportunity to speak with one of our tax professionals to give you the best guidance when these type of questions come up. So again, I'm going to put a little pin on this question and make sure that we reach out to you before the end of the week to try to get you a response to this from one of our tax professionals. All right, Norman, so let's take a look at the questions that people have been submitting online. And the first one looks like it's from Lewis. Lewis is asking, when a lien is placed on real estate, do subsequent interest and penalties get added to that lien?
The answer is yes. So the purpose of the federal tax lien is just to give notice to other creditors that the IRS is in a certain place on a security interest on that property. And so if it's being sold, for instance, escrow is going to request that the IRS make a demand. And so the IRS demand may be more or less than the amount stated on the recorded tax lien because either the taxpayer could have paid it down, and so the balance is less than the amount recorded, or the taxpayer could have not paid anything towards it, and it's been accruing interest for all these years, and it could be more. So the purpose of the recording of the federal tax lien is just to give notice. It doesn't tell anybody what the amount required to release the lien is. That's only known when the IRS makes a demand in escrow, which is basically saying we need X amount of dollars in order to release this lien.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Lewis, hopefully that helps you there. I have Claire. Claire's asking us about the audio session and access to be able to replay it. So just so everyone knows, after this live forum ends, you will get a follow-up email with the link to our website that you can replay not only this event, but previous events. So if you, in case you missed last month's meeting or forum, you can also go onto our website and replay them. So we will send that information out to you, Claire. That goes out automatically to everyone that attended today. So next question here online is from Martin. I've tried for over a year to get the IRS to respond to my client's information and to start some manner of resolution. What should our next step be?
I guess file a 911 with a taxpayer advocate. If the IRS isn't responding to your request, then I would get the taxpayer advocate involved. It's a form 911. And I think that will get the ball rolling and at least get somebody there to respond.
All right. Jessica has a question regarding CSED dates. She's asking about the tolling and CSEDs. Isn't there a delay with the software IRS when tolling is currently happening? So she's referring to if you're reviewing a transcript and there's currently in bankruptcy, for instance, is there a delay in how that gets reported on the transcript?
Yeah, sometimes it can take a while. So, for instance, what you want to look at is on bankruptcy are two codes. One is, it will say bankruptcy pending, and then it will say pendants bankruptcy complete or whatever. And so it's told for the time between when the bankruptcy filed and when the case was either discharged or dismissed plus 6 months. So that's the other thing you want to look at. It's told not only for the amount of time in bankruptcy or appeal or something, but also added time. So for instance, a pending installment agreement tolls the statute, but a pending installment agreement is the time between when an installment request is submitted and when the installment agreement is either accepted, and in that case, it's only been told for those two dates. It's not told for the time that the installment agreement is actually in place and the taxpayer is making monthly payments, or if the installment agreement is rejected, it's from the date of the taxpayer submitted the request to the date that the installment agreement was rejected plus 30 days, because the taxpayer has 30 days after an installment agreement has been rejected to appeal it. If they appeal it, then you have an appeal, which is more tolling. So, every tolling event has two codes, when it begins and when it ends, and then you add amount of time, any time, depending on the code, from 30 days to 6 months.
All right. Yeah, it's definitely not that easy to try to figure that out when a lot of things are happening actively. So it's important to know these differences. All right, looks like we have time for one more question, and this is from David Norman. David has a very interesting question here that I haven't heard myself. He says, I have a client who made a $25,000 estimated tax payment for 2018 taxes. She owes over $150,000 in back taxes. The IRS took $19,000 of the $25,000 she made on EFTPS to back taxes and only left $6,000 in 2018 estimated taxes. She does not have the money to pay the tax before filing as a result. She will default on her current installment agreement. She does not want to do the work to get a new installment agreement. Anything she can do to not avoid her current installment agreement from defaulting, because she now owes for the current year because the IRS reapplied her estimates.
So estimated payments are considered voluntary payments, and they need to be applied pursuant to the taxpayer's request. So I'd like to know how these estimated payments were made. Were they made by check or online?
And made it online, EFTPS. And
with a 1040 ES? And were they designated to be applied to, you know, estimated payment for the current year? Because if so, I don't know why they would apply it to other years. I would call and get them moved back to the year that they were intended for. I mean, and I don't know if it was a lump sum payment of 25 or 25,000 paid over the year, and whether or not when they were made online, whether or not they were specifically designated as estimated payments for that particular year.
Now, assuming that
they were, and you have a receipt to show that, you know, the payment confirmation, I would ask that those be redirected.
And you think the IRS will give pushback there, Norman, if they wanted to apply it to the older liability first?
Well, the thing is, it should be applied to the current year, if that's where they were designated. And if he owes, then he's going to just apply that to the balance, and then he's going to actually owe on the return.
Right, and that's his issue.
And they're going to pay that. Right. So I don't see why they were directed somewhere else.
Right. All right. Makes sense. David, let us know how that works out. So the recommendation is to contact them and have them reapply it, provided that you have.
And if there's a problem again, you could always go to the taxpayer advocate.
Right. All right, guys, I'm going to wrap this up now. That's all the time we have for questions. I do want to give you a quick reminder. Our next practitioners forum is coming up on September 3rd. And we do have, as a reminder, for the month of August, free webinars going on every tax Tuesday. So check out our course calendar. I pushed it through in the chat box, so you should have a link for that. Also, consider, for those of you who have a lot of interesting questions and those that need additional follow-up, sign up for our VIP membership. Remember, it's a two-month free trial. Take it for a spin, and you're not going to have to pay anything for that, and still use some of that consultation time that is available to you. Final reminder, our November 14th event is coming up. I did push a link for the early bird special. That does expire today, so please take advantage of it right away and sign up now. Again, thank you all for joining us today on Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum. We look forward to having you attend our other events and also seeing you next month on September 3rd. Thank you all. If you have any questions, give us a call here at the office. Talk to you soon.